Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. And from Rambana and Ricci, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office, self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ricci, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
The Parkland school shooting sparks yet another debate about gun control. Are black students being left out of the school safety discussion?
We have never seen this kind of support for our cause, and we surely do not feel that the lives or voices of minorities are valued as much as those of our white counterparts.
Also this week, Florida's college system is looking for official recognition in the state constitution.
We represent the counties that we draw our student populations from largely.
We'll also get a look at some of the bills signed into law by Governor Rick Scott this week, including one that allows more education programs in the state's prisons and another that prohibits anyone under the age of 17 from getting married in Florida. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. The conventional wisdom had been, this being an election year and all, that lawmakers would leave Tallahassee for good at the end of the legislative session 3 weeks ago. After a session that had everything from lawmaker hanky-panky to a tragic school shooting that prompted jaw-dropping changes to the state's gun laws, no one could imagine anything luring lawmakers back to the Capitol. But now it seems the House and Senate could be coming back into session before midsummer. That's because legislative leaders revealed Thursday of this week that they were in behind-the-scenes talks with the Seminole Tribe on not only trying to get the tribe's gambling compact back on track, but also addressing the whole sticky matter of gaming, even as a November constitutional amendment might strip lawmakers of having much say on the matter in the future. Much more to come. Watch this space. After the February mass shooting that left 17 people dead in Parkland, are the voices of black students being heard fully in the gun violence debate? Sasha Cordner digs into a complex issue to bring us more on that story.
When you think of Parkland students, the names of David Hogg, Cameron Caskey, and Jacqueline Corn may come to mind. Another name in the forefront is Emma Gonzalez, whose speech following the Parkland shooting garnered national attention.
Politicians! Their gilded House and Senate seats funded by the NRA telling us nothing could have ever been done to prevent this. We call BS! We say that tougher gun laws do not decrease gun violence. We call BS! They say a good guy with a gun stops a bad guy with a gun. We call BS!
Still, besides Gonzalez, an 18-year-old of Cuban heritage, some minority students feel they've been underrepresented in this debate.
I am here today with my classmates because we have been sorely underrepresented and in some cases misrepresented.
That's Tia Moy Roberts, another student at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. While she says she doesn't want to take away from the good work her fellow students have done, she insists this is not the first time students have tried to have their voices heard on gun violence.
The Black Lives Matter movement has been addressing this topic since the murder of Trayvon Martin in 2012. Yet we have never seen this kind of support for our cause. And we surely do not feel that the lives or voices of minorities are valued as much as those of our white counterparts.
Included in Florida's new gun safety law is a requirement that each school district and superintendent work with law enforcement agencies to assign one or more safe school officers at each school. It may include school resource officers, a school safety officer, or a school guardian. That school guardian program allows for the arming of some teachers and other school personnel as part of a voluntary guardian program. It's up to the school superintendent as well as the local sheriff's office to decide whether to join the program. Broward County School Superintendent Robert Runcie's school district includes the Parkland School. He also represents the Ford Association of District School Superintendents. Association members say they didn't receive enough funds in the budget to put a law enforcement officer in each school across the state. Superintendent Runcie, who also happens to be Black, says their viewpoint is simple: more funds for resource officers.
Pay for to have trained law enforcement professionals on campus and allow us to have more of them. Don't put guns in the hands of teachers. They have a challenging job as it is.
But Black students like Kai Kerber say when it comes to those who want more funds for more officers, he fears having more officers on the campus will make minority students feel like potential criminals. He also feels the officers may need more training.
It is estimated that 1 in 3 police officers suffer from untreated post-traumatic stress disorder. When mentally ill police officers are invited to safeguard a traumatized student body, that becomes a recipe for disaster. Police need to stay in the perimeter of our schools. Those chosen to work at school should receive PTSD counseling and special diversity training.
Before Wednesday's press conference with Black students, Kerber did speak on a national TV show in early March. He was the lone Black student on a panel with 4 other students on Comedy Central's Daily Show with Trevor Noah. Noah asked Kerber about his thoughts on arming teachers.
And if I'm being honest, you know, I don't want to seem like that guy, but, you know, me being a minority in the South and having a teacher, you know, have a gun, regardless of color, it does not make me feel comfortable. And even, you know, when you have, you know, resource officers who are, you know, taking matters into their own hands, I don't think that lethal weapons have a place in the school environment. And right. If you need to have some kind of weapon to, you know, defend people, I do believe that it should be a non-lethal option.
Right.
Meanwhile, some Black students who don't go to Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School have started garnering some national attention. One is Naomi Wadler. During the recent March for Our Lives rally, the 11-year-old Virginia Elementary student spoke about the importance of highlighting Black women and girls who lost their lives to gun violence.
Me and my friend Carter led a walkout at our elementary school on the 14th. We walked out for 18 minutes, adding a minute to honor Cortland Arrington, an African-American girl who was the victim of gun violence in her school in Alabama after the Parkland shooting. I am here today to acknowledge and represent the African-American girls whose stories don't make the front page of every national newspaper. Whose stories don't lead on the evening news.
There is also Yolanda Renee King, the granddaughter of Martin Luther King Jr.
Children will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream that enough is enough. And that this should be a gun-free world, period.
And during the gun control debate in the Florida legislature, the color of a student's skin was not lost on members of the Black Legislative Caucus. When it comes to arming teachers, some like Ocoee Democratic Representative Camille Brown feared how the legislation at the time could impact students.
We could be creating an entirely different problem for Black and Brown students. While a vast majority of our teachers are wonderful people, there could be situations where guns are actually used against minority students because a teacher says that he or she fears for her life and the safety of others.
Brown also argued teachers could claim stand your ground in that type of scenario, but according to Florida Politics, Democratic Representative Bobby DeBose played a huge role in having that defense excluded from the gun safety bill. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Florida is reinstating a law that requires elected officials who are seeking federal office to resign from their current jobs. Governor Rick Scott today signed the bill that returns the state's resign to run law to the way it was before 2008. The Republican-controlled legislature changed the law to help then-Governor Charlie Crist in case he ran for vice president. Some state senators in recent years have been able to run for Congress without having to resign from their legislative posts. The new law requires anyone running for Congress to turn in a resignation letter 10 days before qualifying. But the change will not apply to Governor Scott if he runs for the U.S. Senate. After consulting with Scott's office, lawmakers tweaked the bill to exempt those who were planning on leaving office at the end of their current term. Still to come on Capitol Report, after being deemed unconstitutional by a U.S. district judge, Florida's felon rights restoration process has created a rabbit hole of possible outcomes.
There are all sorts of irrational requirements that they might impose here, and we might have to file yet another suit over those. So we'll just have to see how that shakes out.
A new Florida law turns prison cell blocks into classrooms.
You know, minimum requirements are a high school diploma, some of which these men and women have not obtained.
A new law aims to protect children from being forced into marriage.
This closes a loophole so that children cannot be used and abused by folks who, under normal circumstances, would go to jail.
And dinged 6 years ago by its higher education accrediting body, Florida A&M University is on the verge of getting a glowing report card.
If FAMU was in compliance with the 90 standards, and furthermore, they did not have any recommendations.
The presidents of Florida's 28 state colleges have unified in support of a Constitution Revision Commission proposal that recognizes the college system in the Constitution. Ryan Daly reports college system stakeholders feel the move is long overdue.
The state's K-12 education and university systems have had their place in Florida's Constitution for some time now, but its college system, serving more than 800,000 students, has waited for that same consideration. Jim Murdaugh, president of Tallahassee Community College, says the CRC proposal would define the college system's governance structure in a way similar to that of universities.
What it does is it codifies our governance structure in the Florida Constitution, just as has been done for the university system, for example.
The CRC has considered two similar proposals that address the college system, but Commissioner Nicole Washington's proposal is currently getting fine-tuned by the Style and Drafting Committee, a step away from being on the ballot in November. Washington's measure would have a local board of trustees oversee each individual college, and the State Board of Education would continue oversight of the system as a whole. To Murdaugh, a local board of trustees made up of residents of the college's service area means increased ability to cater to local needs.
We report to the State Board of Education just as the 67 school districts do. And that structure is not designed just to bring together to ensure what I will call more uniformity across the system. It's ensured to make sure that we address the local needs based upon the trustees who govern us, who represent the counties that we draw our student populations from largely.
The move will leave differences between the governance structures of the college and university systems, Murdaugh says.
The structure of the universities is to have a board of trustees, but then there is an oversight board, the Board of Governors, that meets and brings all the universities together from around the state to address their collective impact at the state level.
Ava Parker is the president of Palm Beach State College. Like TCC President Jim Murdaugh, she is a member of the Florida College System Council of Presidents. In a recent editorial in South Florida's Sun Sentinel, Parker backed Nicole Washington's proposal, saying it would help colleges respond to growing workforce needs. Commissioner Washington's proposal defines the college system's purpose as creating clear pathways to baccalaureate degrees and specifies it is intended to respond to workforce needs in the region. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Daly.
Judge Mark Walker's decision on Florida's felon voting rights process has breathed new life into the restoration debate. Andrew Quintana reports by declaring the process unconstitutional and giving Governor Rick Scott a deadline to create a new system, Walker has opened the door to many scenarios.
Melvin Blackshear is an ex-felon who says he has been disenfranchised by Florida's restoration process.
The society want us to reform, to rehabilitate, and become part of society, but without our civil rights, we're really not, you know, part of society.
Blackshear has been out of prison for more than 5 years and is found without his civil rights. Readjusting to a normal life is an uphill battle.
They don't realize what we go through to try to better ourselves. So we need those rights. Those rights are important. Transition programs, reentry programs are good, but that's just half of it. We need our rights. We need that.
Blackshear is one of the 1.5 million ex-felons who are waiting for their voting rights to be restored under Governor Rick Scott's restoration process, a process that was deemed unconstitutional by U.S. District Court Judge Mark Walker. Walker has ordered Scott to come up with a new set of neutral rules by April 26. John Sherman, senior counsel for Fair Elections Legal Network, explains what Walker's neutral ruling could mean.
He said that the changes they have to make to the voting restoration scheme have to be robust and meaningful. They have to be specific. He said they could no longer rely on discretion and subjective criteria. They would have to have specific neutral criteria, is the phrase.
Sherman worries the open-ended ruling opens the door to more trouble.
Whatever they do, though, it may lead to other constitutional issues. So if they create a new scheme that has irrational, you know, uniform, non-arbitrary, but completely irrational requirements.
But Carol Weissert, a political science professor at Florida State University, says Walker's decision could lead to a system based on common sense.
The severity of the crime that was committed, they might look at how the person has lived his or her life since then. I mean, there are a variety of kind of things that sort of common sense makes sense, right, that they might be looking at in terms of coming up with this. But I think this is what the judge is saying, just come up with some of these rather than have no apparent criteria that make it look like it is. The decision is not being made on kind of on a rational basis.
Weissert says the issue lurking behind this situation is Amendment 4, which restores felon voting rights immediately after their time has been served. The amendment is on November's ballot and was placed there by a citizen-led initiative that garnered more than 750,000 signatures. Weissert believes if Scott does make a change to the current system by the deadline, then proponents for the amendment might have to change their campaign strategy.
People who are in favor of that might have to argue that they why it should be in the Constitution. I think they can make that argument. I think that's a pretty good argument to make, because governors have so much, you know, because we've changed several times under different governors. But I think it would be a less compelling argument than the one they have now.
A spokesman for Governor Scott has said Scott will be reviewing Walker's ruling. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Andrew Quintana.
Florida prison inmates will have new education opportunities under a law just signed by Governor Rick Scott. Sean Mulcahy has the story.
In an overinflated job market, finding work is difficult. And for people who have served time in prison, it can be nearly impossible. But a bill signed by Governor Scott could better prepare prisoners for the job market. The Florida Department of Corrections can now partner with local school districts and the Florida college system to provide some prisoners with vocational training and post-secondary education.
Because one of the biggest challenges anyone has, and especially someone who's, you know, been in the prison system, is finding a job.
That's Seminole Republican Representative Larry Ahern.
Especially at today's tier level, you know, minimum requirements, of course, are high school diploma, some of which these men and women have not obtained.
Ahern says the bill represents something that should have been done years ago. He hopes it provides prisoners with the skills necessary to be successful after serving their time. The post-secondary workforce education program provides a range of education options, from career certification programs and apprenticeships to full degree education programs. But Florida law prohibited state funds from being used to educate inmates until now. And St. Petersburg Democratic Senator Daryl Roussan hopes the program will keep ex-inmates from returning to prison.
I'm excited about the fact that when you have a person's body locked up, you must find ways of touching their mind and their heart so that they don't go back out and recidivate. You must give them opportunity to increase, enhance, obtain an education as well as job skills, training.
The bill allows prisoners with 24 months or less left on their sentence to participate in the workforce education program. The DOC can now partner with local school boards, Florida Virtual School, and select charter schools to provide educational, career, and vocational training. In a statement, the DOC said it's excited to provide prisoners with enhanced opportunities that are, quote, a vital part of helping inmates transition back into society. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sean Mulcahy.
A new Florida law bans anyone under the age of 17 from getting married. Regan McCarthy reports Governor Rick Scott has given his approval to the measure, which goes into effect July 1st.
Under the old state law, officials say thousands of children have been married. That's because an exception allowed children to receive marriage licenses in certain circumstances, like if their parents agreed or they were pregnant. Fort Myers Republican Senator Beniquisto says those exceptions created a loophole that allowed children to be abused. Beniquisto filed a bill to close that loophole after meeting with Sherry Johnson, an outspoken supporter of efforts to end child marriage.
Because Ms. Johnson was raped at a very young age by her deacon at church. And when it was found out that she was pregnant, her parents did the unthinkable. They forced her to marry the man who impregnated her as a child. Not only did she have to live with him, they continued their marital relationship and she ended up with the beautiful blessing of six children. But imagine raising six children as a teenager.
Johnson's story is shocking to many, like Boca Raton Democratic Senator Kevin Rader. But it's not unique.
How shocked I was last summer when my wife tore out an article from the New York Times entitled, "Despite Progress, Child Marriage is Still Legal in All 50 States." How shocked I was. I mean, who would have thought that was the case?
According to the Human Rights Watch, thousands of Florida children have been married since 2001. And in 80% of those cases, an adult man married a young girl. Beniquisto initially proposed legislation that would have required all parties to be at least 18 years old in order to receive a marriage license, but some raised concerns about blocking older teens from marrying if they become pregnant. Fort Myers Republican Representative Heather Fitzenhagen proposed an amendment in the House.
We are looking to try to align it in a reasonable fashion to make a limitation that is right, but also recognizes in real life that situations arise in teen years, much like the Romeo and Juliet exception that we have for statutory rape. This sort of patterns itself after that, and we think this is a very good compromise position to allow individuals to make the choices they feel are the right ones for their family.
Fitzenhagen's measure would have allowed anyone as young as 16 to marry if they are pregnant. But child marriage survivor Sherry Johnson worried the rule didn't go far enough. She says 16 and 17-year-olds are still children.
If I was 18 and was able to make that decision and no one was able to push me into a relationship or co-host me into being married, then I think my life would have turned out much better than what it is. I wouldn't have had the struggles that I had.
In the end, the measure passed both chambers through a compromise that allows 17-year-olds to get married, but bars anyone younger from receiving a marriage license. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, Florida A&M University shared some extremely good news with its own community and the community at large today. Every 10 years, the school undergoes an exhaustive examination of almost everything it does, said Interim Provost Rodney Wright.
The review process included a rigorous evaluation of the policies, procedures, and practices that govern our educational program offerings.
The body doing the exam is the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools, SACS for short. It is one of several organizations in the U.S. that bestows accreditation on institutions of higher learning. Accreditation, although voluntary on the part of those institutions, is a good thing to have. It opens up many more financial aid avenues for students, among other things. It also means that courses taken in one accredited school will be recognized by other accredited schools. This week, a SACS committee made a site visit to Florida A&M. There were meetings with administrators, department heads, faculty, students, and painstaking review of school finances and other documents. Not surprisingly, there was much celebration when President Dr. Larry Robinson took the stage at FAMU's venerable Lee Hall Auditorium to make this announcement.
The bottom line is that our on-site team that informed us yesterday that the FAMU was in compliance with the 90 standards, and furthermore, they did not have any recommendations. And that's really...
That verdict, Robinson said, was greatly based on what the SACS committee found when it came to FAMU already looking ahead to new programs promoting greater student achievement.
When this team came and saw how engaged we were, I think that helped make the case that not only are we compliant, but we take this process very seriously.
One of those programs, which will be formally launched this fall, is called Right On FAMU, right being spelled W-R-I-T-E. Robinson says it will emphasize good writing in every single class, regardless of what that class is.
Writing was one of those that we saw would be beneficial to any student in any major.
The initiative happened even before the SACS process began. It was based on feedback from employers, including many Fortune 100 firms, that better writing skills would mean more FAMU graduates hired. Interim Provost Rodney Wright, for one, thinks it's a fabulous idea.
And I know firsthand the future impact that this effort will have on our students, and I look forward to witnessing the transformation in their writing skills.
Just 6 years ago, the school, although still accredited, was under SACS sanction for a number of academic and administrative deficiencies. But today, with a flawless reaccreditation status and near certainty to be conferred in December, there is great joy in Rattler Nation. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Ryan Daly, Lynn Hatter, and Regan McCarthy. We also thank Sean Mulcahy and Andrew Quintana. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And please join us each week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. abletrust.org. And from Rambana and Ricci, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office, self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ricci, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.